Hi, folks. Doug McBurney here. Keeping Bob Enyart live on the radio gives him the ability to promote godly ideas on the terrestrial airwaves. I'm asking you to go online to purchase any or all of Bob's eye-opening Christian resources available in written, audio, or video formats. Go to kgov.com and come alongside Bob's vital ministry and keep Bob broadcasting for another year. That's kgov.com, kgov.com right now to give Bob the essential support that only you can offer.
Warning is truth of the head. It gets beyond all the headlines you read. Don't need lip service with a wink and a nod. You need a man on a mission from God. Well, not to worry, here's Bob Enyart Live.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. I am Bob Enyart, the pastor of Denver Bible Church. This is Theology Thursday. Typically, we look at the news of the day from a Christian worldview. Today, we look at the source of the Christian worldview, God's Word.
With this study of Solomon's Book of Ecclesiastes, we enter dangerous territory. For the student who wants to gain wisdom, Ecclesiastes is perhaps the least likely book from which he can get understanding. I do not recommend this book to young Christians. This is a book that you read and study later in life, later after you have a somewhat of an understanding of the Bible, then you tackle this book. The young Christian very possibly will be befuddled and even discouraged, especially if he's reading it on his own. I suggest young Christians read the New Testament, the Gospels, start in John, I often tell people. Read Genesis and Exodus, go to the Psalms and Proverbs, read Paul's letters. But now we have arrived here at this book where Solomon has lived as the wisest king the world had ever known, but then he turned against God and became corrupted and lived a very wicked life, as we will see. And in his backslidden state, the confused Solomon wrote this book of Ecclesiastes. So this book is for the mature believer, somebody who's grown in wisdom. And Solomon, later in the book, concludes by saying that much study is wearisome to the flesh. You know, it can get wearisome to study theology in the Bible. What can happen is your relationship with God could deteriorate into a relationship with a book. How do you have a relationship with a book? You have relationships with people. But your Christianity could become just an ongoing debate about theology and doctrine, in a relationship with a set of ideas, in a worldview. And that, of course, is a great danger. Now, Solomon had wisdom, but he began to relate to his knowledge rather than to his Lord. And as a result, he fell. And we say that the bigger they are, the harder they fall, and that happened to be true in Solomon's case. He was a giant among the wise, and he became a leader of the depraved. He wrote two great books, Proverbs and the Song of Solomon, and one tragic book, this Ecclesiastes. Proverbs and Song, he proudly put his name to. In verse 1 of chapter 1 of both of those books, he introduces the Proverbs of Solomon and the Song of Songs, which is Solomon's. Whereas in Ecclesiastes, he identifies himself by title and by blood, but not by name. He never mentions his name Solomon. I think the man was too ashamed of himself and his work to start with his name. Instead, he writes in verse 1, the words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Through Proverbs and Song, he writes his name 10 times. Throughout this book, these 12 chapters, Not once does the author's name appear. He doesn't make an effort to be anonymous. He just doesn't use his own name. We will see the clues in the next couple chapters and in other scriptures that Solomon wrote this book after he had grown and become an old man, or it was at least later in his life and in his reign. In backslidden Solomon's confusion, he wrote the book of Ecclesiastes. Verse 2, vanity of vanities, says Solomon. No, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Now, in English, our word vain is the word that we get vanity from. And But vanity doesn't mean typically, or vanity has a much broader meaning than when we use the word vain. Like if someone is conceited or they think they're just, they're just the cat's meow. Well, vanity also has the meaning of useless, worthless. And Solomon uses it to imply futile. Something is futile. Like resistance is futile. That idea of the word vanity. During the career of the wise king, he turned away from God and devoted his life to his flesh. 1 Kings 11 tells us that Solomon married 700 wives. Now, could he remember their names? I doubt it. 700 wives. He might see each one every third year or something. And he took 300 concubines. Now, please turn there to 1 Kings chapter 11. 1 Kings chapter 11. Centuries before Israel's monarchy, Moses was writing the book of Deuteronomy. In chapter 17, he wrote of God's prediction that they would ask for a king. And God then commanded that the king should not multiply wives. He said, don't have a lot of wives. If you become the king in Israel when they have a kingdom, don't have a lot of wives, because you're the king. You could take a lot of wives, but don't do it. Why? Because that'll undermine, it'll distract you from God. And he also said, don't multiply horses and don't gather a tremendous amount of silver and gold. Don't do those things. Well, many wives could utterly distract him from following the Lord. With many horses and a lot of wealth, then he could trust himself in his own might and wealth rather than trusting God. So 1 Kings, starting in verse 4, we've read that Solomon's 300 princes turned away his heart from the Lord. And then verse 4, for it was so when Solomon was old that his wives turned his heart after other gods. And his heart was not loyal to the Lord his God, as was the heart of his father David. Now, David did some very wicked things, right? We all know that. David committed adultery, murder, did some foolish things, things that were very wrong, intensely evil, things that are worse than what we can peg right now on Bill Clinton. But David was sorry. He repented. He was truly sorry. And so God didn't give up on him. God works with us if we have a heart of humility and tender toward God. But Solomon was not like his father David. Solomon did evil things, but he reveled in it. And he stayed in it. And he never repented. And he wasn't sorry. He defended himself, which is what a lot of this book of Ecclesiastes is like. The next verse, 1 Kings 11, 5. For Solomon went after Ashtoreth. Now, we just celebrated Resurrection Day, Easter, which is named after the goddess Ishtar and Ashtoreth. And even Aphrodite, different pagan nations with their different names for the same goddess of fertility and war and reproduction. And that's one of these goddesses that Solomon starts to worship. Solomon went after Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and after Milcom, the abomination of the Ammonites. Solomon did evil in the sight of the Lord and did not fully follow the Lord as did his father David. Then Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the abomination of Moab, on the hill that is east of Jerusalem, and that would be the Mount of Olives, and for Molech, the abomination of the people of Ammon. So right there we have the names of four gods of four pagan nations. And what's neat about the Bible as compared to, say, the Book of Mormon, the Book of Mormon gives the names of the weights of measurement of money, the names of cities and peoples, and they're all make-believe, fictitious. And you never find any of them. In the Bible, all these peoples are known through secular history and inscriptions, and their gods are known. And in many cases, we have carvings or idols to their gods. And when they create the Moabite stone, and they say they dedicate this great document to their god Chemosh. Verse 8, 1 Kings 11, 8. And he, Solomon, did likewise for all his foreign wives who burned incense and sacrificed to their gods. So when it says he built a high place, that means he built altars to these gods. And we've learned in other studies that when they worship Molech, they would take their babies and burn a fire on their altar to Molech and put the baby on the fire and kill the baby as a sacrifice to their god. It's an evil and wicked religion. And here is Solomon rejecting the Lord, who he had firsthand evidence that God was real. He rejected God and turned to all these other gods. Verse 9, so the Lord became angry with Solomon because his heart had turned from the Lord God of Israel, who had appeared to him twice. And we've often pointed out how in the Bible, when God did miracles for people, he appeared to them, he made it absolutely beyond question that he was God. Did that guarantee that they were going to be strong and remain faithful? No, it didn't. In fact, the normal response was that their faith was weakened. They were stronger. Blessed are those who have never seen and yet believe, because they believe based on the word of God, which is the surest foundation for your faith. Not what you see, but what you hear with your ears. And finally, 1 Kings 11:10, and had commanded him concerning this thing that he should not go after other gods, but Solomon did not keep what the Lord had commanded. So let's return to Ecclesiastes. With verse 3, Solomon continues his rant. And what would you expect as we go through this book? A wise man turns from his righteousness to commit iniquity. We don't expect that he's going to forget every good thing he knew, that it's just going to be gone from his mind. Nor do we expect that he'll forget the contentment that he once had, that he once felt a certain peace or tranquility. But we expect that his pride will keep him from returning to the Lord. He won't repent, but he'll wallow in self-pity and groan from the misery that he brings upon himself. So that's what we'd expect if we know that we're reading a book written by a man who is righteous with great wisdom, and now he's backslidden, and now he's writing a sequel. Verse 3, what profit has a man from all his labor in which he toils under the sun? One generation passes away, and another generation comes, but the earth abides forever. The sun also rises, and the sun goes down, and hastens to the place where it arose. The wind goes toward the south and turns around to the north. The wind whirls about continually and comes again on its circuit. All the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full. To the place from which the rivers come, there they return again. Now, I don't think it's a good idea to make much of Solomon's accuracy regarding the water cycle. Oh, look, the rivers go down in the oceans and somehow it goes back to the source of the river. He must be implying evaporation and all that. That totally misses the point. He's simply looking to nature to find illustrations of what he here considers a sign of futility. Since the earth never actually gets anywhere, the sun just keeps rising and setting, the rivers just keep flowing, men just keep working. If you make your bed, you have to make it again. If you cut the grass, you have to cut it again. If you clean the dishes, you have to clean them again. I thank God that for me, household chores, I've learned to find joy in doing chores around the home because I can do them to bless my wife, to care for my children. I can do them unto the Lord who has put me in a garden to till the garden and be responsible for it. Idle hands are the devil's playground. But here we're going to see Solomon gets upset about all kinds of things. Verse 8, all things are full of labor. Man cannot express it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. So no matter how many times you eat, no matter how much you enjoy a meal, you'll have to work again tomorrow to prepare another meal, and your body will desire food just as much as it did today. So where does it get you to eat? That's his lament, as absurd as it is. It is not as though you can satisfy the cravings of your flesh once and for all. We know that. And that's true on many levels. Yet Solomon, because he lacks a loving relationship with God, he sees in this gloom instead of a blessing. I see it as a blessing. He sees it as a curse. I'm thankful that God created me in such a way that I can enjoy a meal today, be filled, so full that I can't see how anyone else could possibly be hungry, and then I can find the same enjoyment again tomorrow, and perhaps even a little too much, though. And the same is true with all pleasures. Pleasure must be cyclical. It can't be constant. It has to be in a cycle. Otherwise, it wouldn't be pleasure. It'd be stasis. It'd be stagnant. It'd be the same all the time, whatever it is. You know, kids love to be tickled. But at the same time that they beg for to be tickled, they're desperate to get away. So they try to orchestrate the situation that you've got them and you're tickling them, but they have a way out and they're trying to escape at the same time. And if they get away, the thing they want is to be right back and be tickled again. And then they try so hard to get away, and that could go on for maybe a couple minutes. But then it's done. They're done. Their need for pleasure and that kind of release, it's fulfilled. And the next day or the next week, and as they grow, it tends to lessen, hopefully. But then they want to do it again. We celebrate with a meal until we push the plate away from us. No more. I'm done. Those brownies look good that Becky brought here tonight. Homemade. Are they brownies? They look great. But I'll tell you, I know even before I take a bite, after the fifth one, I will be done. That's it. We enjoy a cold drink, especially after our palate has gone dry. But then you got to stop drinking. There comes a point pretty quickly where it's not pleasurable. I enjoy relaxing in front of a good video. But if we sit and watch for hour after hour, and then maybe because of depression or out of work or whatever, day after day and week after week, pretty soon it becomes depressing. You know, guys in jail, they get to watch cable TV all day long. And you think, wow, they'd love it. When they're out of jail, that's what they want to do. When they're in jail, it drives them crazy. God has built into us a cyclical function to keep our lives interesting, so we could work with and celebrate our Creator, or with nothing changing other than our attitude, our perspective, we could rant and rave that, why did you make me like this? Why did you make me that I have to cook a meal again tomorrow and eat it all over again? He could take a blessing and say that it's a curse just from your attitude. a disrespect toward God and a lack of humility. Verse 9, that which has been is what will be. That which is done is what will be done. And there is nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which it may be said, see, this is new? It has already been in ancient times before us. There is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of things that are to come by those who will come after. I, the preacher, was king over Israel and Jerusalem, and I set my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all that is done under heaven. This burdensome task God has given to the sons of man by which they may be exercised. Actually, no. Solomon, you got that one wrong. God didn't give us this job to keep us busy like make work in the military. If they tell you, dig a ditch, you dig the ditch, and then they say, now fill it in. God doesn't do that. He doesn't give us make work, and he hasn't given us all the task of searching for wisdom, actually. He's given the mom the task of loving her husband and caring for her children. He's given the child the task of obeying his parents and growing in godliness. He's given the man the task of loving his wife and providing for his kids. He's given the teacher the task of teaching wisdom. And he says the teacher is especially accountable because he is responsible to read the word and clearly read the text and give the sense of the text to the people. That's what God says in the Bible. That's the job of a teacher. And so the teacher has a job, yeah, of finding wisdom and teaching it, and people have a responsibility of learning wisdom. But God hasn't made the search for wisdom a quest for the Holy Grail in which most seekers will die before they reach their goal. God has put wisdom into our hearts. We're born knowing right from wrong. As we grow, we know. Yet we deceive ourselves. So then he wrote it again in the pages of a book. So you only have to read the book and you know wisdom. You don't have to exercise yourself in futility all your life, never being able to know the truth. The task is no more burdensome than praying to God for wisdom, reading his book, and learning to love him each day. You do that and you have wisdom. It's guaranteed. Verse 14, I have seen all the works that are done under the sun, and indeed all is vanity and grasping for the wind. What is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be numbered. So Solomon looks upon the world as a futile place, yet that is because he has confused the functions of our body with the overall path of history. The Eastern mystic believes that history is cyclical, that everything goes in a circle, and after 8,000 years or 80,000 years or whatever the particular branch of Hinduism or Buddhism or whatever they believe, after a period of time, it all sort of starts over again. It's the Judeo-Christian view that taught mankind that history is not circular, but it has a purpose. And that purpose is that God works, even in the midst of man's rebellion, to populate his kingdom. God is bringing people into his eternal kingdom. Us, the righteous men who came before us, God has an overall kingdom that will be forever in heaven and on the new earth. Everybody that's on God's side will be a part of his kingdom. And that's God's purpose. And he is moving toward the fulfillment of that purpose. Now, there are recurring themes in history, and nations come to ruin as previous empires have, and they make the same mistake. And in that sense, history can be seen as repeating itself. But the world is not headed nowhere. Planet Earth is on a collision course with God's plan for eternal paradise. And eventually, our current earthly stage of history will sum up into a conclusion. And with each revolution of the planet, With each orbit around the sun, more souls come to the Lord as he enlarges his kingdom. Verse 16, I communed with my heart, saying, look, I have attained greatness. And notice he says, I communed with my heart. He should have been communing with his God, but he was completely introspective, focused on himself, his own ability to discern the truth. I communed with my heart, saying, look, I have attained greatness and have gained more wisdom than all who were before me in Jerusalem. My heart has understood great wisdom and knowledge, and I set my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceived that this also is grasping for the wind. Notice how he's slipping with his reasoning. He sets wisdom on a par with folly, something he never would have done in his younger years. When you read the book of Proverbs, he doesn't put wisdom and folly on the same setting. That, you know, try to understand the one, try to understand the other, and it's both, it's all meaningless. This is a different Solomon. This is a backslidden Solomon. I will know wisdom and madness, yet I realize this is all impossible. Now, his next line anticipates our maxim, ignorance is bliss. You've heard of that? Ignorance is bliss. Well, here's verse 18. In much wisdom is much grief, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. Ignorance is bliss, yeah, for the moment, until the consequence of inaction hits. Once the end result of folly makes itself felt, then ignorance is no longer elates someone. I'm so happy. I'm ignorant about what the public schools can do to my kids. I'm ignorant. And now my kids are destroying themselves. Well, at that point, ignorance is no longer bliss. So that's just another statement of folly. Now, chapter two, we read about the 1960s college professors who experimented with drugs. That's what this chapter is about. It's an analysis of that period of time written 3,000 years before they did their own research. Imagine the lives that could have been saved if Timothy Leary, instead of exploring heroin for its ability to give pleasure and insight, if instead he had just read of Solomon's similar experiments. They failed Solomon just as they failed Timothy Leary. But then again, men of foolishness doom themselves to march in their failure parade of the centuries.
Hi, folks. Doug McBurney here. Keeping Bob Enyart Live on the radio gives him the ability to promote godly ideas on the terrestrial airwaves. I'm asking you to go online to purchase any or all of Bob's eye-opening Christian resources available in written, audio, or video formats. Go to kgov.com and come alongside Bob's vital ministry and keep Bob broadcasting for another year. That's kgov.com, kgov.com, right now to give Bob the essential support that only you can offer.